Bunker, right here in North Central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
Morning, Moon's Day. How about that? We're back in the saddle again here at the bunker. Yeah, we had a wild one again last night. A thunderstorm, lightning all over the place, rain like hell. My trash cans were tossed all over the parking lot, and the trees, some of the limbs came down, and wowee, I turned off all my computers, and then every time I turn them back on, it always takes me a little while to get them going again. So we had a little slow start this morning. It is the 3rd of August 2015, and we're ready to go here in the bunker right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse, and that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard right out here where all summer, spring, summer, and fall, you can bring your 18-wheelers in here. Look at all this military equipment out here, kick the tank treads and stuff like that, and look them over. We'll even let you get in, like, who was the guy that ran for president, that little guy that got in the tank and put a helmet on? He looked like a midget. what the hell was his name? Anyhow, I think it lost the election for him. But anyhow, well, you can get in them and drive them around a little bit as long as you don't knock any of my trees down. We're always getting the new stuff in here, and when you pull your 18-wheelers in here, make sure you get them off the side of the road. Don't want my neighbors to get mad at me. And look, we bondo up all the bullet holes and RPG holes and stuff like that, and then we paint them, and we'll give you a free paint job any color you want. A lot of the gals like pink, you know, so you should be getting ready now for next spring's assault. You know, it won't be long. Time passes fast. Yeah. Anyhow, okay, let's get back to business here. Jerry the Jew's over there in the corner. We waterboarded him again last night, and he's not feeling too good, so he's not going to say anything. I don't put a muzzle on him. He can talk whenever he wants, as long as he doesn't talk too much. And I don't want him talking in Yiddish, because that drives me crazy. Well, I mentioned at least one new movie last week. I believe I mentioned it to you, called The Guest. And I'm not going to tell you much about it, but I'm going to tell you, you need to watch this. You need to watch this, and you'll get all kinds of ideas and get you thinking about things, you know, especially how rotten the government can be. It's not the government, it's a gang of thieves, that's all. And that's on Netflix, and then I believe this one was on Netflix too, called Preservation. And boy, I'll tell you, that's a double feature you don't want to miss. Preservation's about survival in the wild, and I'm not going to give you any hints about that either, because if I do, it's going to give you an idea how what's going on in the movie, and I don't want to do that. But just remember, the first movie is The Guest, G-U-E-S-T, and the second is Preservation. Now, my webmaster just sent me the name of another one, which I haven't checked out, and I'm not sure whether she did or not. It's called The Child of God. Something tells me I've seen this film, but I'm not sure. I'll check it out, and if I haven't seen it, or if I have seen it and it's a good movie, I'll let you know. Well, we got a nice donation in here, as we do about every month, from, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but they'll know who it is. It's going to be enough so we can get some money orders to send out to the 5 or 6 inmates that we try to support and help out. These are not people that I have just met. These are people that have been around for a long time, and they've paid the price. Yeah. And we've added a new one onto our list to send a little money to each month. You usually send $25 a piece, and that's to Eric Rudolph. Yeah. I haven't heard anything back from him, and I don't need to get anything back from him, but if he wants to write, that's fine too. So anyhow, we got another one on the list that we're helping out there. That's right. Well, I got a nice letter from inmate George Loeb, who was a creator when he went into prison a couple of decades ago, defending himself from a crazy-ass Negro, to which he killed the Negro. And it should have been self-defense, of course, but it don't work that way anymore. He says, "Of course I'm paranoid. If you really knew what I've been through and how it all ties together with the federal government, you would be paranoid too. And maybe you should be. Your name was mentioned here recently, twice. First, your name was mentioned as part of the cover story. Cops started talking to me about my mail and grievances. He wanted to tell me the outcome of all that, wink, wink, as if I didn't already know. And he didn't know which was really interesting. So I dummied up and merely listened. He said only one thing that was significant. He said, quote, the government doesn't want you to receive mail from Tom Metzger. The phrase, the government, was the key. He didn't say the warden, DOC, or the state. It seemed like a tacit confirmation coming from the top. I also note, with the expiration of some federal Patriot Act items, I'm suddenly getting my mail. Anyway, that was your name mentioned. unprompted. But it wasn't about you. It was bait to see if I would talk about certain racial issues here in the prison. And I don't, and I won't, ever. I don't work here, and I engage in no casual conversations with the cops either, ever. Anyway, the second mention of the name Metzger came from an inmate. It's a long story, but the guy knew about the grievances concerning my mail. And as we were talking, I mentioned how we used to go to the county jail to put money in the commissary accounts for certain people. The guy said, "Do any of your people ever put money in your account? Tom Metzger or any of those?" Well, as always, I deflected the question, and I put the guy on the list of those likely working for the state, perhaps all the same. Psychologically, it's just sport here. Wait a minute. Whoa. Hearing things that other people sometimes miss, things out of character that makes your antenna go up. One example, and I'll wrap this up. I asked a guy if you could trust one guy here with something crucial his writing is hard to read here. Sorry about that. He said it was tough, and eventually he named someone, but he didn't ask me the same question. I found that to be very odd. Tonight I'm considering the significance of that. The entire something here is like something from a spy novel. I think all of America is getting to be that like that, with Big Brother tracking our cell phones or license plates or cars per se by one star and so on. I don't get that. I might buy a vintage car, not because I'm doing anything wrong, but just because. I don't quite get that. Well, gotta go. Again, thanks for your letter and your thoughtfulness and the funds. Much respect to you as always. Keep up the good work for our people. Well, that was from George down there in one of the rottenest prisons in the country in Florida. I just put a note on the internet that Jeb Bush should be ashamed of himself for having a name that comes from one of the great generals of the Civil War, General Jeb Stuart, and he should change his name immediately. We suggest Jose. He's so proud of his race-mixed family now. I wonder what the old man really thinks about that, George Bush Sr. Well, I guess you heard by now a couple of churches out in New Mexico were bombed. Evidently, they were minor bombings, but it might be interesting what's behind that. I'm sure we'll find out as the famous but incompetent are rushing to the spot. I was scanning the internet a little bit here, and I ran across an article that appeared, I forget the name of the magazine or newspaper, but it was about a Klan rally that took place in Janesville, Wisconsin, about 15 years ago. It twisted the whole story around because Geraldo Rivera was there, and for the second time he had his nose broke. John McLaughlin was there, and Geraldo got right in his face. John McLaughlin's a good friend of the Mahon brothers. Anyhow, Geraldo got right in the face with his microphone to McLaughlin, and McLaughlin smacked him and broke his nose. So not only did he get his nose broken by the Metzger group on his TV show, but he got his nose broke again in Janesville. But they turned it around and tried to make it look like Geraldo smacked McLaughlin. That just shows you how the press lie and historians lie and how you can't really trust history books. I guess you see how they're trying to eliminate black history through the black back door. And trying to eliminate the position of the white race. by starting at the back end in history and making the Confederate flag a horrible thing and so forth. And now they've jumped to Jefferson Jackson. Now, I'm not one who worships so-called forefathers, because they're not my forefathers, but they did do a lot of things, and I do have a high regard for Jackson because he took on the central bank and shut them down in this country. And that was something else. And he opened up the West for white settlement. And, of course, that, so they accused him, whoa, he did these horrible things to the Indians. Well, maybe he did, but if the Mongols had been in power and had the strength that they did in Asia, and we were a small group of white people there in Asia, they would have done the same thing to us. So I'm not crying over that anymore, the Mongol problem. So, but you see how they're slowly taking, now the first thing you know, they're going to eliminate these names from history books in the schools. It's a process of race change in North America, and now, and to do that, they're going to change the history or just eliminate the history they don't want. It's very clear what's going on, and it's speeding up, and it's going on every day. And I hope you notice this, because this is exactly what's happening. If they get their way, there's going to be the day come where people say, white people? No, they were never here. No, it was just the Indians, the Mongols, and the blacks, and the white race never even was in North America. That's what they're working on. There's a town near where I live here called Goshen. It's got a strong element of Seventh-day Adventists there. They've got a college and everything, and of course, anywhere you've got a religious Christian college, you're going to see them start changing things real fast. Well, they had a football team called the Redskins, and they have gone to the city council and the school board, and they've gotten rid of the Redskins, to which I wrote them an email and said, I want to thank you very much for getting that despicable name of Redskins off a team which is mostly whites and maybe blacks even, that do not want to have their team sullied by Mongol labels. So whenever a sports team changes the name to get rid of something they call a nasty title, Redskins or whatever, you never see them call a team. Do you ever see them call a team nigger? They never did that in the history of the country. But anyhow, whenever you see something like that, email the city council or the college board or whoever it may be that made the decision and say, thank you very much. I've been wanting to exterminate, if you'll pardon the expression, these names ever since I've been a little kid. I don't want any team being called by these non-white wagon burners and all that kind of stuff. We want white labels on all teams, so thank you very much. Or even lions and tigers and zebras and all that kind of stuff, because that's much better than referring to a football, basketball, baseball team connected to Mongols and maybe Negroes or something. But they haven't really done that for Negroes. I wonder why. You'd think maybe there's some obscure black college that has. I don't know. I think, isn't it Atlanta that's got the Atlanta Braves? Well, they should change that to the Atlanta Niggers. It'd be more apropos. You know, they keep showing this picture of this monkey guy crawling up the flagpole down there in Georgia or North Carolina. Well, wherever it was that. Taking down the Confederate flag. Well, believe me, buddy, it's not that easy to take down a race. You can take down a flag. I would rather have the non-equal sign anyhow, so get your felt pens out, boys and girls, and wherever you go, put up the non-equal sign. Let's see if we can get them to come at that like they do at the Confederate flag. The non-equal sign is much purer as far as racism than a Confederate battle flag, because a lot of Negroes fought on the side of the South under that battle flag. Well, here's a little story that you probably haven't heard about the Civil War. You may be getting tired of hearing about the Civil War, but in the spring of 1861, Missouri's militia, the National Guard of its day, established an encampment called Camp Jackson in the Lindo Grove area of St. Louis, Missouri, intending to conduct a six-day training exercise. Around this same time, delegates of the Missouri State Convention voted to remain in the Union, as long as they didn't have to engage in combat with any of the other states that had seceded from the Union. Basically, the intent was to keep Missouri neutral in the coming war. There was a great deal of political intrigue taking place in Missouri at the time, and political leaders from both sides were engaged in attempts to outmaneuver each other, both politically as well as militarily, should the state break into armed conflict. The St. Louis Military Arsenal's commander, Union Captain Nathaniel Lyon, believed that the anti-Union troops were planning on breaking into the arsenal and stealing the arms and ammunition. As a precaution, he moved the arsenal's weapons to a location in Illinois, then marched several thousand federal volunteers to Camp Jackson to confront the Missouri militia troops. A large portion of the federal troops were German immigrants to St. Louis, and not made up of local citizens. That just shows you how immigrants will be used against the regular population when things get tough. Like they'll be recruiting all these Mexicans to go after you and me. Outside of Camp Jackson, a large crowd had gathered to watch as their 800-plus Missouri militia surrendered to the federal troops under Captain Lyon's command. Emotions were running very high with insults as well as rocks and other debris being hurled at the federal troops from citizens gathered along the streets of St. Louis. All that was needed was a spark to set it off. To this day, it's unclear who was really responsible for the tragedy that followed. Whoever fired the first shot has been lost to history. What is known is that the federal troops under Lyon's command opened fire and killed 28 civilians that day, at least a quarter of them children, and they were white. The other result was that these Missourians who held Southern sympathies prior to that date were forced firmly into the Confederate camp. Those with Northern anti-secessionist allegiances remained loyal to the Union, as ultimately did the state of Missouri for the remainder of the war. Though with 1,200 battles and skirmishes throughout the state, Missouri remained contested for the duration of the conflict. Much of the fighting taking place was brutal, bloody guerrilla warfare, which helped to give birth to later outlaw legends Jesse and Frank James. So there you go. You can see how it works. And it'll happen again and again and again, like the song I sing, The Highwayman. Again and again and again. That's right. Now, these Germans coming over were fleeing from losing the War of 1848, the revolution over there in Germany, and they were offered citizenship, of course, to do the dirty work for the Federals. That's how it goes. Hey, and for those of you who thought you could work with the Arabs, how about this one? Arab News has published an article praising United Arab Emirates' new anti-hate law, saying that the country has set an example in dealing with the racism. It further says that the law serves to establish a proper relation between members of society and install civil peace, written by big long name Arab here, Rashid. The article says that in the past there existed good ethical standards for rejecting discrimination and promoting coexistence at a time when no laws regulated relations among people and between societies or races. However, communities have changed, expanding mixed and become more complicated. Ethnics are no longer sufficient as a ethics are no longer sufficient as a control, and customs have stopped deterring people from harming each other or violating others' rights. There you go, that phony word rights again. In Lebanon, a group has been formed to defend the rights of or privileges of domestic workers. Most of them are foreigners prevented from socializing with the rest of society in Egypt. More race mixing. The citizens of Upper Egypt have complained about the media and the cinema making fun of them. The situation is more dangerous in the Gulf, where provocation amounting to incitement and blasphemy and reaching the level the government officials inciting to kill. The article further states that the modern societies in the world are seeking to develop laws promoting social peace and making the state home for all. Worldwide race mixing, man. You can't have any opinion on anything other than race mixing. They're developing laws that ensure the protection of the weakest groups, which is anti-nature. You cannot do it. It will not work. Survival of the fittest and evolution will not tolerate that. There's no country in the world that has not undergone this difficult transition. Saudi Arabia banned slavery 100 years after the U.S. banned its in 1866. All societies change. The old and the modern need to develop their regimes to deal with the changes. Politics has tarnished social relation in the Arab world. When the relationship of the state gets tarnished, hostility is reflected in the same direction, and when it is fixed, the brotherly and friendly language between the state and society is reinstalled. In our society, that is crowded with foreigners. When a foreigner kills a local, the language of the media and the social networks degenerates, blaming the whole community on the perpetrator, and then it starts to spread hatred, and the Arab news said the Arab News article. The problem is not only experienced by foreigners, it is a sectarian problem to begin between Sunni and Shiites, and an ethnic one against the other, the Bedouins. It is a regional problem as well as working against people of certain regions, and disrespecting them as has become a cause of discrimination against them. These contemporary diseases persist and spread due to the lack of explicit regulations, defining responsibilities and establishing guidelines. Yeah! Shiites and Sunnis have been living in the same area for 1,000 years. In order to remain living together, the modern state has to enact regulations and laws that grant them equal rights and punish those who violate that right, that privilege. You read between the lines of this thing? The United Arab Emirates recently introduced the first comprehensive law dealing with racism, hatred, incitement. And this law deserves to be read in detail. The law criminalizes acts associated with the contempt of religious and holy sites, religious discrimination, and hate speech using any form of media, unquote. The most severe penalties are against the government officials who face jail terms of 10 years and fines of $500,000 or $136,000 if they commit during work hours. Those who exploit religion and accuse others of blasphemy will be imprisoned. Penalties might reach the death penalty in cases of murder. The author says that the purpose of this law is not the mere application of sanctions. Rather, it serves to establish a proper relation between members of society and install civil peace. You're fighting Mother Nature there, boys and girls. It ain't never going to work. The protection of societies and their rights, privileges, is not a matter left to the wishes of the people. Oh, so the government has to enforce it. That's called dictatorship. It cannot be the subject of referendum. Even in democracies, the opinion of the majority regarding the issue does not matter. Whoa! Wait a minute. Even in democracies, the opinion of the majority regarding this issue does not matter. Get the point there? So in other words, the majority cannot change the country. However, the article says it should be expressly stated in a constitution, and the international community should hold accountable any government that does not adhere to these values. Guess where this shit's coming from? I can see right through this stuff. It's a worldwide control network being set up to suppress any deviancy, any tribalism, anybody that wants to do things differently. Going on all over the world, boy, the ruling class is really hard at it to make the world safe for the ruling class. But it ain't gonna work, never did work, never will work. Well, let's get back to Terror in the Night, otherwise known as guerrilla warfare, Southern style. Lewis declared he would be delighted to see Nussbaum, the rabbi, leave the Jackson area, but had been advised by the synagogue's board of trustees that the rabbi was under contract that had 5 years to run. In that case, Lewis advised that as long as the rabbi was affiliated with the synagogue, he felt there was going to be trouble in the Jackson area for the Jewish community, unquote. A few weeks later, Binder and Robert Berman, who was president of the Beth Israel congregation at the time, invited Roy Moore to address the men's club at the temple. Moore brought pictures of some of the Klansmen he suspected of violent acts. Berman took a stack of 3x5 inch headshots home, put them on the top of a dresser. Several days later, he arrived home from work to find his housekeeper shaking with fear. That's the day Jackson Clarion Ledger had carried the photographs of the two Klansmen being sought in the shootout with Jackson police, and she had recognized them as two men who had been painting the inside of his house. You see how it works? This is the only way it will work. "You better lock your door and car tonight," the housekeeper told Berman. "Your house painter's pictures are in the paper." "What in the world are you talking about?" Berman asked. She showed him the pictures of the Clarion Ledger newspaper. "Oh, my God," he said, and rushed to his dresser to see if the photos had information supplied by the FBI matched those in the newspaper. Both photos and dossiers were gone. Berman contacted Moore, told him what had happened, and asked if Moore thought he and his family might be in danger. Moore told him to stay alert and keep in touch with the Federal Bureau of Information, but said that seeing the pictures in your house probably was the best thing that could have happened, because now they'll know you know who they are and will worry that many other people have photos of them too. Now that's an interesting way of trying to reverse the psychology. On December 20th, 1967, the FBI got what could have been a major break, cruising the streets of Tiny Collins, Mississippi, on a cold, rainy evening. Buster Lott, the night marshal, became curious about a car with Alabama license plates that had pulled into a closed filling station. Lott stopped to investigate. The driver, who produced an Alabama driver's license, had no satisfactory explanation for what he was doing so far from home in such an unlikely place. "Like it's none of your business, cop." And Lott seemed to recognize the name on the driver's license of the other man in the car, Samuel H. Bowers. Lott took the two into custody. On the front seat of their car, hidden beneath a sweater, he found a .45 caliber machine gun. The FBI and the state police were called in. Thomas Albert Terrence III was charged with illegal possession of a machine gun, a federal violation. Terrence's cover was blown. He and Bowers were publicly linked. They had come to Collins to machine gun the home of a black man whose civil wrongs efforts had drawn their attention, but the authorities were unaware of that. For the moment, though, the FBI made no connection between Terrence and the bombings, and he was released on bond. Moore and his agents were still looking in all the wrong places. The FBI believed Bowers was relying on the sort of Klansman who has always done his dirty work. As pressure on the FBI to solve the bombings mounted, the Bureau turned up the heat on all known Klan suspects. Not least among them was the volatile Danny Joe Hawkins. On one occasion, Danny Joe and his mother, Johnny May, reacted so belligerently when agents appeared at their house that the agents called for reinforcements. FBI memos described Danny Joe as cursing and yelling incoherently, and reported that accompanying his mother and his wife Kathy, a beautician, he advanced towards the agents in a fit of rage and shouted, "You goddamn sons of bitches, set one foot on my property and I'll kill you." His mother pushed Agent Sam Jennings, shouting angrily, "You dirty sons of bitches, you better leave here now." When the backup car arrived, the Hawkinses retired into the house. The Bureau considered the Hawkins family one of the meanest and most violent families it had encountered anywhere in Mississippi. Well, I'll tell you what, when I was in their house years ago, I was served tea and crumpets. We had a very genteel southern visit, and I didn't detect any of that. Of course, you know, you gotta have a cover. Danny Joe, baptized Joe Daniel, was 24 years old in 67. He was ranked among Bauer's most trusted night riders. In fact, I think he was at the meeting at the house to keep an eye on Bauer's, even to watch me, I don't know. One FBI memo referred to him as a key man in the hit squad. The memo also noted that Bauer's had been in contact with Robert Bolivar Depew, leader of the Minutemen, a violent paramilitary group, and one of the FBI's most wanted fugitives, and warned that Bauer's, Hawkins, and Depew were all considered armed and dangerous. Depew was on the run, I think, at this time from a bank robbery he had pulled. I met Depew once at his home in Norbourne, Missouri, when we had a big meeting back there. I talked to him privately where he admitted that he was not really a racist. He was an anti-communist, he was anti-government and all that, but he said he was not a racist. FBI agents and Jackson police often made spot checks of Danny Joe's residence three or four times a night during their bombing investigations. Bureau bulletins reminded the agents on several occasions that both Danny Joe and his father, Joe Denver Hawkins, 44, a construction worker, were known to carry firearms and explosives. Employed on the loading dock of a trucking terminal, Danny Joe Hawkins weighed a solid 170 pounds and stood 5 feet 10 inches tall. He had thick, dark brown hair, eyebrows, and was Hollywood handsome. Tattooed on his left upper arm was "Cat" for his wife, Kathy. They had a 6-year-old son named Jefferson Davis. Interesting that my wife at the time was Kathy, too. When Danny Joe was growing up, his father worked for many years with the Shelby Construction Company, a nationwide building firm that Danny Joe called the Big Jew Outfit. The family moved frequently. As a teenager, Danny Joe was often in trouble and was picked up once for petty theft. He quit school in the 9th grade at the age of 16. 2 years later, he participated in a violent protest at Ole Miss. A week after that, he got his first visit from the FBI. An article in the White Patriot, a publication of the Americans for Preservation of White Race, contended that the FBI threatened and intimidated Hawkins. He denied being intimidated, but he said the FBI sources confirmed that the agents did offer him money and told him he could be driving a Cadillac if he would testify against the leaders of the Ole Miss riot. He refused. See, that's the way these ruling class people, they think they can buy everybody off, and they can, most people. But there are people out there, and myself included, that you can't buy, boys. You don't even try it. Later, sensing his connection to the Mississippi bombings, the Bureau kept constant pressure on Danny Joe and his wife. following them and interviewing them frequently where they worked. That's a favorite method the FBI uses. They used it a lot back in the 60s. They would come around to your place of employment and ask your supervisor, whoever, foreman or whatever, they want to talk to you. And, of course, all of a sudden, everybody in the whole place knows the FBI's interrogating you, and usually you lose your job. Obviously, they could make arrangements of interviewing somebody at a restaurant or someplace else, but that's not the game. They use that as an intimidation practice. And they'll do it again. They do it all the time. COINTELPRO is not dead. It was just a little bit sleepy for a while, but what's going on now is even worse than COINTELPRO. It's getting a lot of people killed through bombing and so forth by talking people into, encourage them and getting them into projects to build bombs and all that kind of stuff. It comes right out of the FBI. On one occasion, the hot-tempered Hawkins responded by telephoning Moore and telling him, "You better tell your damn goons to leave my wife alone." Now, this is a guy talking to the FBI. Now, these are the kind of guys, these guys had real balls. "You better tell your damn goons to leave my wife alone. I'll escort you up the courthouse steps one day," Moore answered. "I'll see you in hell," Hawkins shot back. Hawkins' nerves might fray, but the FBI did not crack him, and his toughness was to prove costly for the Bureau and for Mississippi's Jews. Danny Joe, more than anyone on the FBI's target list, could have provided the elusive link between the White Knights and Terrence. No wonder Moore was frustrated. What with the unsolved bombings and now a fresh series of cross-burnings that were spreading renewed terror, the FBI agent was in foul mood when Ken Fairley, a Jackson Clarion-Ledger reporter, stopped by his office. "Moore was really upset," said Fairley, and said, "I'm not going to have this kind of violence in this town, and knowing Roy, I know he meant it." Fairley, who later would go into the police work himself, recognized Moore's irritability as part of the wider frustration that extended to the state law enforcement officers. Yeah, they were upset. They couldn't make arrests. They couldn't get anybody because they were smarter than the cops and the FBI. The authorities in Mississippi might not sympathize with the civil rights movement, civil wrongs movement, and those who supported it, but the Klan's blatant flouting of the law was giving both state and its police a bad name. "The best thing we could do is to booby-trap a church and let them set it on fire and blow them up," one of the state investigators told Fairley, "and nobody would say anything about it." "That wouldn't exactly have met due process standards," Fairley said, "but that's how they felt. It was an idea whose time was drawing nearer, to set up Klan members. And they'd been trying for a long time to set up Klan members. The way Al Binder saw it, the Jews of Jackson were virtually friendless. They could not look to the city fathers or the religious leaders or to the police force, which was riddled with Klan sympathizers. The Jews' only reliable allies, he concluded, were Roy Moore and the FBI. Although they made an unlikely team, Binder and Moore inevitably were drawn together. Binder was political, gregarious, and socially ambitious, a short, stocky, cigar-smoking juice spellbinder on his way to wealth and certain fame as a criminal defense lawyer. He had never taken his religion very seriously. How many Jews do? He was a latecomer to the Temple Beth Israel. Through his views on handling the White Knights had quietly prevailed. Moore, solidly built and medium height, was personification of the FBI's straight arrow legend. Sure, from the tips of his regulation black wingtip shoes to the top of his close-cropped hair, he was so no-nonsense pursuer of criminals. He had no time for storytelling, social climbing, or politics. Not like Jed or Hoover, except the Kremlin-esque survival politics of the Bureau, which he played skillfully. Moore talked in clipped sentences laced with law enforcement jargon. He drove his men to exhaustion, but commanded total loyalty because he worked as hard as they did. He was the ultimate disciple of cross-dressing faggot J. Edgar Hoover, though he was prepared to bend the director's idiosyncratic rules when he needed to. For all these, their differences, Binder and Moore would prove to be an effective team, two utterly pragmatic men who shared a preference for action over talk and a determination to lift the scourge of Klan guerrilla warfare. Roy Moore grew up in Hattiesburg, Illinois, a small town on the Ohio River in the heart of the coal fields. His father ran the hardware store, and Moore attributed his early knowledge of bombs to the fact that the store supplied dynamite for the mines. After graduating from high school, he joined the Marines and quietly took to the disciplined life of the Corps. Promoted to corporal, he was sent to Quantico Marine Base near Washington, where he taught marksmanship to recruits at the FBI training school. There he was so impressed by the young college-bred agents that he resolved to join the Bureau when his three-year enlistment was over. Knowing the FBI preferred men with college degrees, he studied accounting, got a degree, and in 1940 became a special agent. I believe at that time every FBI agent had to have a degree in accounting, if I'm not mistaken. He specialized in investigating sabotage during World War II and established a record as a painstaking investigator. He was an innovator and a risk-taker. Other agents were so fearful of Hoover and the possibility of exile to Butte, Montana, the Bureau's equivalent of Siberia, that they went strictly by the book. But if Moore saw an unconventional way to make progress on an investigation or to assert jurisdiction over a case he thought deserved FBI attention, he would try it. In 1955, while assigned to the Denver field office, he directed the investigation of a United Airlines plane crash that made his name in the Bureau and set a precedent that the FBI follows to this day. The plane bound from Denver to Portland, Oregon, exploded and crashed 11 minutes after takeoff. 39 passengers and 5 crew members were killed. The local sheriff asked Moore for help. The FBI had never before investigated the cause of a plane crash and had no apparent jurisdiction, but Moore ordered agents to the crash scene. To cover himself, he located a wartime sabotage statute, giving the FBI peacetime authority to investigate interference with communications, transportation, or anything else that could be vital to prosecuting a war. It was enough to hold his superiors at bay while he pressed his inquiry. Resourceful as always, Moore borrowed 200 enlisted men from the nearby camp, nearby army outfit, and put them shoulder to shoulder in search for evidence. He commandeered 2 Air Force trucks and outfitted them with electromagnets, which picked up thousands of pieces of the plane and 6 remnants of the bomb. I'm surprised. I figured that plane would be mostly made of aluminum, and magnets are never going to pick up aluminum. That's strange. 35 years later, he could recall the smallest details of the crime scene. It was 2 miles long and 1 mile wide, and we had to get the evidence out within 24 hours because we had a snowstorm coming over the Rockies. We brought it back into Denver and laid it out in the hangar and started manufacturing the baggage compartment of the plane. We found a hole in the Denver baggage compartment. Studying the passenger list, Moore turned up only one person from Denver, a woman named Daisy King, whose son Jack had been in trouble with the law. Digging into his background, Moore discovered that he had studied electrical wiring and that recently he had taken out an insurance policy on his mother's life. After intensive interrogation by Moore, King broke down and confessed. He probably beat the shit out of him. If you're going to go down for murder, you're not going to confess. Unless they use physical intimidation and violence. That's my opinion. 9 years later, Moore's thoroughness broke new ground for the FBI again, this time combating Klan guerrilla warfare. The pressure to produce had come straight from the top. The crook president, Lyndon B. Johnson, one of the most corrupt presidents that had ever been in the Oval Office, faced with rising national concern over the three missing civil rights workers, knew he would have to institute major changes in federal policy. At the same time, Johnson ran that ranch down in Texas with slave labor niggers and Mexicans living in tar paper shacks, no better than under the plantation system. Johnson, like John F. Kennedy, had recognized that vigorous federal support for civil rights movement would threaten Democratic political support in the South. Like Kennedy, he had sought to win a measure of Southern cooperation through reconciliation and negotiation, but the tactics of restraint had met with only limited success. Uncompromising resistance to nigger rights for blacks remained the policy of the great majority of public officials below the Mason-Dixon line. And the disappearance and apparent murder of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman suggested that where civil rights activity was concerned, even the most basic guarantees of human safety would not be provided. Johnson sent Alan Dulles, the retired director of the Central Intelligence Agency, on a fact-finding mission to Jackson. And you got to dig into the history of this son of a bitch and the deals he made in Europe and all kinds of stuff. That's a whole another two or three books, Alan Dulles. After 2 days of conferring with state and local officials, civil rights workers, civil wrongs workers, and business leaders, Dulles returned to Washington and recommended that FBI forces in Mississippi be increased and instructed to control and prosecute guerrilla warfare activity by the Klan and the Americans for the preservation of the white race. At the same time, Dulles called on the National Council of Churches and other groups sponsoring the Mississippi Freedom Summer Program to warn students that if they entered Mississippi, they would be in very, very grave danger. The FBI had maintained a full-fledged field office in the Mississippi capital during World War II, but after the war, the office was closed and Jackson was served only by resident agents. Now Johnson quickly embraced the idea of an expanded FBI presence in Mississippi, hoping to head off demands for an even stronger federal intervention. With civil wrongs volunteers pouring into the state and electing officials across the South breathing defiance of the law, the pressure on Washington to act had become irresistible. A nationwide Harris poll found that an overwhelming majority of Americans favored sending federal troops to Mississippi if the violence escalated further. Our own worst enemy, white people. I remember those days. I remember. I went to California with a kid that graduated from my high school when I made my first trip to California. And he had gone down there and marched with those bastards. And guess what? He was a Jew. He's dead now. He died of drug overdose. He was into drugs. But back at the time, in those early 60s, I wasn't thinking much about Jews. By late June, Hoover had more than 100 FBI agents in Mississippi, but the massive ground search for the three civil rights workers, coupled with the growing flood of civil wrongs complaints, overwhelmed them.
These white people are not fair to us. They sure aren't.
Hoover decided the only answer was to reopen a field office in Jackson and staff it with as many agents as it took to get the job done. Moore, at 50. Now, meanwhile, there's all kinds of black crime going on in the North and the South. And they're not sending any FBI agents to solve that problem. Moore, at 50, was eligible for early retirement and was weighing an offer from the Hilton Hotels Corporation to head its security operations worldwide when Hoover called him on July 1st. This happens all the time. These guys work for the government, and then they go back into private corporate business. It's a revolving door operation. You'll see all these politicians. They'll come many times. They'll come from corporations. They'll go into government for 3 or 4 years, maybe a little longer, and then they go back into the corporate business. It's an incestuous combination, and it's screwing the country. The director wanted him to go to Jackson. Moore would have 10 days to obtain space, equipment, and personnel sufficient for an official opening to be attended by Hoover himself, the cross-dressing faggot himself, that obviously to any geneticist could see had Negro blood in him. Moore never gave early retirement another thought. You know, I've never read a story about the beginning of Hoover, where he came from, who his mother and father were, all that kind of stuff. If you have researched that, let me know, because the rumor has been around a long time that he had Negro blood in him. But he didn't need to have Negro blood to be a bastard. In Jackson, he rented the 7th and 8th floors of the around-the-clock push that somehow had the office ready on time for the dedication ceremonies. On July 10th, Hoover and a covey of aides arrived at the official dedication aboard Air Force One. All that for maybe, what, maximum 50 guys maybe in the Klan. I mean, maybe 20 serious ones, and out of that, 10 who were really serious. Air Force One, do you realize how much it cost to fly that son of a bitch? Before making such trips, the director, always sensitive to criticism, insisted on thorough briefings on friends and enemies he might encounter. The confidential briefing book he carried with him to Jackson left no doubt that the Bureau was prepared to embrace some of the state's staunchest segregationists so long as they would support the FBI. We got the same thing today, boys and girls, in the right wing and the Republican Party, the conservatives. Same goddamn thing. You couldn't trust them as far as you could throw them. And they'll laugh at your joke if you tell a racial joke. Or they'll have a drink with you and all that. And they'll say, boy, I like what you say and what you stand for. Don't ever trust them. Don't ever, ever trust them. The book called Jackson Mayor Alan Thompson adamant in opposing integration, but a firm believer in law and order. Joe Patterson, the Mississippi Attorney General, although critical of the Supreme Court decision and the Department of Justice, has always expressed admiration for Mr. Hoover, especially when he stood on his box to make himself look taller, and the FBI. The FBI's relationship with the arch segregationist who ran the Jackson Papers, Robert Hederman and his brother Thomas, had been very favorable, and Hoover had corresponded with them about their favorable articles on the FBI. But you see, that's the way that paper was way back then, but now it is an absolute flaming pro-Jew, pro-Negro, Negroes are wonderful paper, and they spend much of their waking hours investigating white races. I was going to dig out the name of the reporter. He's made his whole life career in that Jackson paper, chasing white racists. I'll look it up. I was going to look it up over the weekend. I've got his phone number here someplace. In fact, I may stop this and see if I can find it. Well, I got out one of my old phone books, and I didn't find it, but it's amazing. I haven't looked through that thing in a long time, how many people I've got in there that are dead, who washed out, or who have washed out completely in the racial struggle. People that swore they're on their mother's grave they would defend the white race till the end of time, and that book reminds me of how many people just washed out and didn't do a damn thing, and they're gone. And a whole lot of people who are dead. At least the ones who are dead died at the time they were doing something. It's amazing to me, it's funny to me, that when the ATF came in and tore my house upside down, that these old phone books they never touched. there's no evidence that they touched them at all. They were tearing other things apart, looking through file cabinets, but they didn't look at the phone books. So anyhow, ATF's never been accused of being the brightest bulb in the light, I'll tell you that. Okay, back to where we're at. I'll find that, because I know I've got it around here. But if you go on to the Jackson newspaper, the Jackson Ledger, it's easy to find his name. All kinds of anti-Klan, all kinds of Klan articles are written by this one guy who works for that paper. I've talked to him before. He's an arch integrationist, and that's it. Once they're into that crap, he thinks he's doing things for God and country, and he'll keep doing it till he passes away, probably. That's one of the hooks in race mixers or integrationists, is that they're doing the Lord's work. This is a good thing. What they're doing is righteous. What you're doing is evil and horrible, and the devil's making you do it. You see, once people fanatically get into a position like that, it's very rare you can ever slap them out of it. They have to be slapped out of it by things that happen around them. Like, there's a lot of people going to get woken up really the hard way as time goes on, and with the economy collapsing and all that. And when it comes down to getting food for your family and trying to establish a place to stay out of the rain and like that, you'll find that a lot of these so-called religious racial integrationists will start changing their tune when it's survival of the fittest. And that's what we need, because the race is too weak. It's too weak and materialistic, and it's not going to get any better or change until catastrophe strikes. That's what I think. Hoover was advised to be wary of Robert A. Halberg, the U.S. attorney in Jackson, because during a conference with Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy on civil rights cases, who incidentally the mob wiped out, there's no doubt now in my research that the mob killed Kennedy, and it was a warning to John Kennedy, and he didn't get the message, and so he got it too. Halberg had contradicted Mr. Hoover on several occasions, which placed the director and the bureau in an embarrassing situation several times. To prepare Hoover for a press conference, the briefing book included a list of possible questions and recommended answers. Some of the answers underscored the FBI's contention that the South was no different from the rest of the country when it came to violence, and that communism was a driving force behind the civil rights movement. Well, it was one of the driving forces. There's no doubt about that, and Soviet history can prove that. Soviet Principle 10, that it was one of their main planks, was to mongrelize white America. And anybody that says it wasn't is a goddamn liar. Question, is there any Communist Party activity among the civil rights workers in the South? Answer, I testified before Congress, the House Subcommittee on Appropriations, earlier this year that the communists in this country had organized very intensively in a drive to infiltrate into the racial discord and discontent in the country. The party is not honestly interested in improving the status of the Negro. It seeks to present itself as a protector of the minority group, but its actual fact is it's interested only in trying to advance the communist cause. I think I'd rather say the Jewish cause, because such a high percentage of the communists in the Communist Party were Jews, and almost all the spies were Jews. And you heard me say before what there was. Tremendous number of Jews marching in these civil wrongs parades and all that kind of stuff. So I think we should drop the communists and say it was a Jewish issue. At the formal opening of the new FBI office, Hoover stuck to his prepared script in answering questions, including one about whether the FBI would protect civil wrongs workers. We most certainly do not and will not give protection to civil rights civil wrongs workers. In the first place, the FBI is not a police organization. It's purely an investigative organization and the protection of individual citizens, either natives of this state or coming into this state, is a matter for local authorities. But Hoover made it plain that the FBI planned to pull out all stops in going after the Klan. He took the occasion to order that 50 more agents be assigned to the Jackson office. You know, the idea that adding more and more and more is going to solve your problem is a fallacy that police use and FBI use. They get in each other's ways, they can develop leaks among them, and there's Klan sympathizers even in the FBI. Yes, there is, just like there's sympathizers to the white struggle in the FBI and ATF and all of them today. I won't go on into it because we do not want to endanger those kinds of people. But they're out there, and it's called Lone Wolf. Lone Wolf can be an FBI agent, he can be an ATF agent, he can be a senator, he can be a congressman, he can be a bank president, he can be an automobile mechanic, he can be a ditch digger, or whatever. That's why Lone Wolf is the only way to go. Well, that's about it for today. I'm going to have to call it off. I think it's very interesting. A lot of things are recharging my memory banks. A lot of the stuff that at one time I had some knowledge of, that lost a lot of knowledge of these facts. So anyhow, it's interesting for me to go over this, and I hope you're getting some good stuff out of it and good ideas on protecting yourself and understanding that a little bit of paranoia is very good as long as you don't let it go too far. 14-5, but lean on 5. 5 is the main thing. I have nothing to say.